Thank you for coming back to the Inside Lacrosse Podcast. I'm Terry Foy, and I am joined by U.S. Lacrosse CEO Steve Stenerson for a very special edition of this show as we talk to one of my friends, a colleague that I've gotten to know pretty well over the course of the last 5 or 6 years since assuming my role at IL. And it was recently announced that Steve will be departing the organization after a multi-decade tenure, the only leader in the history of U.S. lacrosse, by the end of 2021, being a part of the search for his successor and certainly a celebration of all that he accomplished. So, Steve, first and foremost, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Terry. Thanks very much for having me.
So obviously this was substantial news throughout the lacrosse world and landscape, given the role that U.S. lacrosse plays in that. But for listeners that might not fully understand what exactly the organization is and does and what your role is within it, can you just kind of give a brief description to set the table for what the transition to the next kind of era of U.S. lacrosse means for the sport as well?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, as some of your listeners know, back in 1998, I was part of a leadership group that was looking to kind of organize the sport in a way that was more centrally focused and far more collaborative. And so we looked to Olympic sport for a model in that regard. And that is the national governing body model, this unification of constituencies to generate revenue to reinvest in the development of the game. And so we were very fortunate at that time to get key stakeholders for each of the major constituencies, men's and women's lacrosse, coaches and officials and different levels of play. And we were successful in merging 8 of those organizations, including one that I used to work for, the Lacrosse Foundation, into forming U.S. Lacrosse. And the whole idea there was, again, to aggregate all the constituencies around not only national strategy to grow the game, but also kind of collaboration on generating resources to focus on growing the game. And so over the last 2 to 3 years since the formation of the organization, I've been focused on working with a growing staff and a growing national pool of board members, committee members to really focus U.S. lacrosse on being this this leverage point for growth and development of the game and creating the infrastructure kind of required to really position the game for growth. And that's everything from sports science and safety research to understand better what's happening in terms of injury on the field at each level of play so we can make good decisions about rule interventions or equipment interventions or education interventions, to creating standards for coach and official recruitment and development and education, to grassroots granting programs that are focused on helping seed the game nationally, all the way up to our national team program. So really a plethora of activities that are fueled by members and donors and sponsors of the organization through this unification and the creation of U.S. Lacrosse 22 years ago.
And as CEO, obviously you oversee the organization, you interface with the board, you interface with all the public-facing constituencies that you talked about. So generally speaking, how do you describe your role?
Well, I think I'm part, you know, a big part politician to some degree and, you know, a big part convener, you know, trying to, you know, our organization benefits from the collective wisdom of our staff. And in a typical non-COVID year, we've got 90 plus staff here. And we also benefit from the wisdom and experience of our national board of directors, our committees and subcommittees. All of whom represent just hundreds of years of experience and perspective and bring not only, you know, their experiences with the sport throughout the country, but also their experiences as business people and professionals in a variety of careers. So really trying to aggregate so much passion and experience with the game around common objectives. And, you know, that's really tough because as you can imagine, every constituency within the sport has its own perspectives about what's most important in the sport and trying to kind of aggregate those different perspectives into some common focused strategic priorities is really what my job is about. And then the obvious second phase of that is execution against those strategic priorities. So, and it is, you know, we're a nonprofit organization, a 501c3 nonprofit. So we're We spend all the resources we generate on the mission, the people and the systems and the investments we make to fuel those priorities. But trying to continue to get people to work together on common objectives and priorities in the best interest of the sport is really what I do. I certainly manage our national staff and oversee that. I'm the primary board liaison to that on behalf of our national staff, and I'm the primary spokesperson and, as I say, representative with respect to our conversations with each of the constituencies within and outside the sport who are so critical to the game's growth. So that's what I do in a nutshell.
It's a big job.
Well, it is. It's a misunderstood job, I think. And, you know, as I say, one of the strengths of our sport that we'd like to celebrate is the passion that we have for the game and the relatively close-knit community that this relatively small sport represents. I mean, national participation has more than tripled since 2001, so that's some pretty significant growth. But that passion is also sometimes an impediment to progress, because there are people entrenched in their beliefs. There are people that have more, more selfish interest in the sport. I don't mean that in a negative way. They're coming from a challenge or problem or a perceived challenge or problem from their own perspectives. So, you know, trying to get people to rally around common beliefs and therefore common solutions is really challenging sometimes. But it's the thing that's kept me moving forward over these many years.
And that's a good segue into, after 23 years, making the decision to step aside and what prompted that and what it means for the future, both for you and for the organization. But a couple of things that I just want to make sure that listeners fully understand is how successful U.S. Lacrosse has been in developing itself as an organization under your leadership, particularly relative to NGBs of like-sized sports, particularly those that have either Olympic opportunities or professional opportunities, whatever the case may be, that exceed lacrosse, and yet that hasn't been a hindrance to U.S. Lacrosse's ability to develop as an organization. And not only that, but also a tenure as long as yours, if I understand this correctly, is very rare in this field. So both of those elements speak to a job well done. But that being said, what prompted you and the board to collectively make this decision now?
Yeah, well, let me give you some background. First of all, I've been with U.S. Lacrosse since 98, but prior to that, I was with one of the eight organizations that emerged to form U.S. Lacrosse, dating back to 1984. So, I got out of University of North Carolina with a degree in journalism and had a vision to write for the New York Times one day. And of course that was a pipe dream. And I got out of school and worked for a small publishing outfit in Baltimore prior to desktop publishing. So I was actually doing, wax paste up. A position at an organization called the Lacrosse Foundation opened up. The Lacrosse Foundation was based at Hopkins Newton H. White Jr. Athletic Center. It was formed in 1957 and was really initially formed to, among other things, honor the greatest players and establish the National Lacrosse Hall of Fame. But in more recent years, back in the 70s and 80s, it was really focused on trying to grow the game. And so at age 24, after a couple of years working at this publishing house, I applied for and got the job as an executive director of the Lacrosse Foundation. And, be careful what you wish for at age 24. So I guess my point is, Terry, that, I've been doing this for 37 years and, the scale of the job has changed obviously considerably, but it's been a long stretch. And I haven't regretted a single minute of it. Lacrosse was, played a very transformative role in my life. Team sports generally did. I grew up with my own share of family dysfunction as a kid, and team sport throughout grade school and high school was kind of a saving factor for me in the adult influencers who were my coaches were really incredible male role models for me. And lacrosse was a big reason I was able to go to the University of North Carolina and get a degree in journalism, et cetera. So I felt a real emotional connection to the transformative power of sport generally and lacrosse specifically because it happened to me. So that's kind of been my driving passion over these many, many years. But it's that total of 37 years that I think is the primary reason that it's time for me to move on. You know, I started conversations with the board leadership a couple of years ago about succession planning. Those conversations kind of were evolving at the beginning of last year. And then we had, some tragedy. We lost a COO we had just hired soon after he was hired, George McGinney. Within a month or so after that, COVID hit and, you know, it was head down mode. And so the idea of succession planning, particularly with founder leaders of nonprofits, which is sort of what I am. I certainly didn't found the organization by myself, but I've been with the organization since its founding, and it's really important for nonprofit organizations to actively engage in those succession planning discussions far in advance, which we did. So I was ready for a change, and the organization I think is ready for new leadership, and the timing was just right. So as we kind of started to see the light at the end of the tunnel as COVID was, you know, kind of the end of the summer, early fall, we started to talk about opening back up our hiring processes and those conversations about succession planning and timing were rekindled. And we, you know, I was able to agree with board leadership on a timetable and circumstances that would effectively let me give me enough runway that I needed and give the organization enough runway to choose a successor. And that's where we are, a good place for both.
So what's next for you?
My mantra is I'm excited about not knowing what's next. And that's uncomfortable for me. I've reached a point where, again, it's time for a change. While I'm incredibly thankful for the opportunities of the last in my professional life, the last 37 years, two roles, it is time for a change, and it's the role has been wearing on me for a while, and my wife will be the first to share that with you. So I'm going to take some time. You know, I'm going to support the transition of the new leadership here, obviously. I've invested too much time in this organization to not do everything I can to make sure this transition is smooth and effective and to position my successor for far greater success than I've achieved. And so that's my commitment through the end of the year. And that search will begin very shortly and likely conclude sometime over the summer months. And then I'll transit and work with the successor for a period of time to kind of make sure he or she is well positioned. And then I'm going to take some extended leave away from work for the first time in my life. And I'm going to, let my mind clear a bit, catch up with some old friends, and then kind of figure it out. I think I've got a few more years of something in me left. I think probably I don't see myself in a similar role. I see myself for the same reasons that it's time for me to leave this organization. I don't think I want to step into a similar role moving forward. I think I want to do something more on the social service side, if possible, and really get a different kind of psychic income moving forward.
And as far as the organization is concerned, obviously, early days of the search and certainly an aspect of the candidate pool determining maybe a little bit of the direction that it takes as well, but certainly you have been a part of strategic planning processes for US Lacrosse and you're familiar with the board and board leadership to the extent that you know what their thoughts are in terms of what's next. And I think, again, for folks listening to this, when they think about US Lacrosse, they probably think about US Lacrosse Magazine, they think about the national teams, and those that are better informed probably think about the idea of Olympic inclusion, certainly in 2028 in LA, and potentially the role that an organization like US Lacrosse would play in something like that. But I know that there are so many details and there are so many aspects of the operation that are, I don't want to call them more mundane, but certainly below the radar compared to some of those high profile elements of the entity. When you try to get a sense or kind of frame your expectations for what you think board leadership is looking for from your successor, what comes to mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the big topics about nonprofits of late is, you know, historically it was all about your contribution, kind of a high percentage of your contribution going right to the mission need. So going directly to the individuals to whom the mission is focused. And more recently, and even last night, I was watching 60 Minutes with an interview of the CEO of the Ford Foundation, who was reiterating this particular point that, you know, what nonprofits also need is to invest in themselves, in their infrastructure, in their people, in order to be able to better execute against the mission moving forward. You know, traditionally that was kind of frowned upon, that, you know, you had to, you know, you wanted to shoot for 90% of every dollar going directly to the communities you served. But the more modern approach to nonprofits is a balance. You can't grind your staff to pieces, underpay them and expect to attract great talent, and where you can't operate an effective business on a shoestring without the appropriate technology infrastructure, things of that nature. So to your point, I think U.S. Lacrosse has really, its mission is relatively fine-tuned. We got a long way to go, believe me, in terms of the organization, achieving its potential fully, really zeroing in on a lot of the issues that have long been a part of the game, but are now thankfully really a focus, you know, the nature of inclusivity in our sport and accessibility and diversity. Those are, you know, that is the future of our sport's growth. And so the organization has done great work in that regard and has much more great work to do. You know, many of the other, as you say, mundane components of the infrastructure, from, you know, creating the first national standardized education curricula for coaches and officials, and, you know, really leaning in on grassroots development issues, all so many different things that are part of our organization's infrastructure. So, but I think that mission component is well positioned and will improve and evolve as necessary. But I think one of the things our organization needs to focus on is the commercialization side of things, and making sure that we're generating the revenue necessary to achieve kind of that mission potential in the long run. And so I see someone, certainly one of the higher skill sets, qualities, levels of experience in the candidate pool, I think, is going to be on that commercial side. You know, looking at opportunities for U.S. Lacrosse to stay true to its mission, but look for opportunities to be more influential, strengthen our position of advocacy, and generate additional revenue to fuel the mission.
So with all that being said, let's just kind of open it up a little bit more. And one of the things that I think is so advantageous of being in a position like the one you're currently in is the opportunity to reflect. When you think back over the course of your tenure, is there one thing that emerges that you're more proud of having been a part of accomplishing than anything else?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, I will say this as the beginning of my answer, as I've shared with a couple people, life is a team sport, and none of what this organization has accomplished is as a result of my singular actions. I've been very fortunate to be in a position to lead the organization from a staff perspective, but I've been surrounded by incredible people who are committed to the organization, to the mission, not only on staff, but in terms of board leadership. Incredibly selfless people who give their time and their resources to fuel our mission in some amazing ways that people really will never see. it's the organization's success and the organization's collective of staff and volunteers and donors and members and sponsors that has been the reason the organization has achieved its level of success today. What I'm proudest of, there are a bunch of things I'm proud of. I mean, I guess in reverse order, grinding through the last 12 months and making sure the organization was in a position to initially survive. I mean, none of us knew what was going to happen, on April 15th last year. And, we rely, when the sport's not being played, obviously that has a really negative impact on our revenue, membership, donors, sponsors, et cetera. So I'm really proud of how the organization has come through. It's not over yet, but has come through COVID. We managed the organization's resources well. We've benefited from incredible generosity from the thousands of organizations that support our membership program and so many donors that came through when we needed it, the organization is in a strong and financial position coming out of COVID. And the sacrifices that people made, particularly on our staff, those who are no longer with us, those who took significant pay cuts, I'm just so proud of them for thinking so much of the organization and sacrificing so much. So I'm proud of my coworkers for going through that period, and I'm proud of those who are no longer with the organization, who really are one of the reasons we are where we are. I'm proud of the facility that we were able to build completely out of private donations, our new, relatively new headquarters we moved into in 2016. It's a marvelous facility and a legacy that will serve the organization well for many years into the future. A home for our national teams, a home for our national staff, and it really is the sports facility. It's our members' facility, our donors' facility, and I'm proud of that asset, which is going to serve the organization well, as I say, years into the future. I'm proud of building the coalition of stakeholders who believed in the importance of unifying strategy and resources towards common goals. We still talk about the challenge our sport faces as fragmented as it is, despite the unification that is U.S. lacrosse. There's tremendous fragmentation in our game, and that fragmentation is caused by differences of opinion, ego, commercial interests, all sorts of things. But a lot has been accomplished because so many have believed in the importance of unified strategy and execution of that strategy. And I think that's been a significant part of the sport's growth over the last 25 years. Not the biggest reason. U.S. lacrosse isn't, the only reason lacrosse is growing. I mean, the main reason lacrosse is growing is because the people on the ground passionate enough to drive its growth. We're simply trying to do our best to support that and put programs and resources around that to make that job easier for those people on the ground in urban and rural America to really expand this game. So I'm most proud of that, of this unified national structure that has done wonderful things, and it will continue to do wonderful things to seed this sport and grow and expand it.
There was a point that you made there toward the end that I want to drive a little deeper on, because it's been something that you and I have spoken about at length multiple times over the course of the last several years. And I think in addition to the financial challenges and the ability to overcome some of those challenges that you just laid out, 2020 will be remembered as a year in which lacrosse's lack of racial diversity among its membership, among its playing group, fell into greater focus and was something that was more frequently and routinely talked about. And there are a couple other similar types of topics that I want to get to, but I wanted to start here just in terms of kind of the ability to look back and look forward with respect to U.S. lacrosse's role and your role personally in trying to make the sport more accessible or appealing for people of color who traditionally haven't represented as large of a playing pool as stakeholders like you and me would hope that they would. What are your thoughts on the progress that's been made, the challenges that have been confronted, and the next steps that must be undertaken in order to increase the welcomingness of the sport?
Yeah, well, first of all, you know, I think it's fair to say that I've been part of the problem. You know, I'm as passionate as I've been about the game and growing the game in all communities. And, you know, early in my career, I was very much involved with what I think is the first urban youth league in the country, the Baltimore City Middle School Lacrosse League, which when I was at the Lacrosse Foundation, we kind of led the creation of. But as passionate as I thought I was about growing the game in all communities, I didn't do enough. And it wasn't as much of a singular focus as it needs to be, and thankfully, as it's become in over the last year. There's tremendous momentum now, and the key is to keep our collective feet on the gas pedal in that regard. That, you know, we've got to constantly reflect on this opportunity moving forward and hold ourselves accountable to this opportunity moving forward. I mean, as I've said many times, the game over the years, in fact, you know, the game is not going to continue to grow in the slivers of upper middle class America. You know, it, the only way it's going to grow is if we can drive it across the country and to every family, regardless of socioeconomic status or geographic location. I mean, that is the key to our game's growth. And it is a sport that must be and should be for every child, every family. And so I think there's tremendous opportunity to keep the pressure on, not just because it's the right thing to do societally, but because it's the future of our game. Our game is not going to continue to expand and grow unless we can make it more accessible to more families, A, and B, the point that I came to too late, B, unless we can make every family feel welcome and that they belong. And that is the battle we're fighting right now. And battle, I say, because, you know, our nation has never been more polarized around so many different things, including race. And, you know, our organization needs to lean into that more. I think we've done a good job over the last year leaning into that, but we did not do anywhere near the job we could or should have prior to that. And, you know, as I've shared with our board leadership before, you know, these conversations, they're not for everyone. And there are individuals within our sport who don't want us to lean into this, who view social justice as, some sort of a political ideology, and rather than, kind of a human rights issue. And this is, we need to double down as an organization, despite the anonymous feedback I get on a regular basis from people who don't want to read or hear or see about our efforts in this regard, who believe lacrosse should somehow be above, these human rights, fundamental human rights issues of access so our organization needs to continue to be on the front lines of that conversation and discussion, because it is absolutely essential to our mission, is to grow the game in every community and make sure that those families know that lacrosse is for them. And that is a generational challenge, sadly, because, as I mentioned, there are too many people in our country and too many people within our sport who aren't interested in that or who don't feel comfortable with that. And so I'm looking forward to, you know, as the organization's leadership evolves and my successor is in the seat, I'm really looking forward to watching the organization lean into that and provide greater leadership in that regard moving forward, because it's the only opportunity for our sport to really grow.
I mentioned that there are a couple of similar types of topics that I wanted to get to, and the next one is, when you reflect on the last decade and the reckoning that contact sports had or is still having with concussions and other head and brain injuries, you, to my knowledge, at one point testified before Congress on this issue, and certainly one of your leading comments relative to what U.S. lacrosse is and does talked about the Sports Science Safety Institute. And so clearly it's an important topic, top of mind, a similar but different issue in men's lacrosse versus women's lacrosse, and something that, as I said, feels like it is not as part of the public consciousness as it was in the early 2010s, but also is not a solved issue, quote unquote. How do you reflect on the way in which that issue evolved over the last 10 years? Where do you see it currently? And what does lacrosse as a sport and U.S. lacrosse as an organization need to do on the issue of concussions and other types of brain injury going forward?
Yeah, you know, when we formed the organization, one of the things that, and I was a strong proponent of this, that we wanted to commit to is establishing a sports science and safety committee that's comprised of, you know, a talented mix of doctors, researchers, and clinicians that could help the sport make informed decisions about rules, interventions, equipment interventions, and educational interventions. And, you know, without that empirical data, that research on injury frequency and severity at each level of play, you can't make good decisions. All you're doing is making emotional decisions. And I'm, you know, you talk about what I'm proud of, and as we talk, you know, these things kind of pop in my head. But I'm really proud of that. We are a best practice among governing bodies of sport, Olympic or non-Olympic, in that regard, in the incredible people that we've put together to help advise the sport and U.S. lacrosse on policy. And, you know, unfortunately, Terry, again, this is something that many are not focused on. You know, the influencers in the game typically aren't focused on safety as a primary issue in terms of scaling participation in our game. I mean, there, when we were working with the industry on, you know, whether it's the development of the of new headgear standard, the creation of a headgear standard unique to the women's game, you know, there are a lot of people that didn't want to see you know, us lean into those important conversations. Certainly the parents of kids who were injured did. But, you know, even in the men's game, you know, we've been a strong advocate for a long time over really reducing, if not eliminating, collision, violent collision at any level in the game. And, you know, I can tell you without naming names, there are a lot of prominent coaches who fought vigorously against that, thought that we were, that our efforts in that regard were, you know, kind of ruining the sport. And they didn't really see the value in us leading conversation in this regard. But, you know, our focus was, you know, just like making sure the game is accessible and welcoming to all, we got to make sure the game is as safe as it can be so that every child, every family feels comfortable with their children playing. And that's a constant balance. You know, the traditions of the sport versus the need to innovate based on new information and creative thought. And that is long, we've been at the crux of that tension since the organization was formed. you know, we were seen by many of the traditional leaders in the game to be either a nuisance or a threat as an organization, a threat to the traditional power structure of the game, when in fact that's not what we were formed to be. We were formed to be a unifier of thought and an aggregator of information so that we could make good decisions and advocate for appropriate strategies. You know, this issue of concussion isn't going away. And part of the problem is that while our organization has developed many different strategies to try to make the game safer, at the end of the day, tournament owner operators, high school athletic associations, they're all making their own decisions, because we don't run grassroots play, right? We don't run youth leagues. We don't run private tournaments. We don't. All of these organizations or companies, we can shout from the rooftops that kids should be playing rules that sync with their cognitive and physical development stages. We can shout from the rooftops that allowing, you know, 12-year-olds to play NCAA rules, which allow a more violent version of the men's game in this case, or allowing girls below a certain age to full check when they don't have the motor skills to do so safely. These are irresponsible, yet, because we know that they're irresponsible because we have data surrounding them, whether it's video analysis of concussion in girls and boys lacrosse, or it's other types of injury research that we have funded or led. We know that this is, one, riskier for kids, and two, most importantly, completely unnecessary. You know, a 12-year-old playing NCAA rules in a tournament is ridiculous, and it's unnecessary. Yet it's being done on a regular basis, and I think that's part of the biggest challenge. Is we have the information now, we have the data, and trying to wrestle individual interests to adopt unified rules, to adopt a focus on what's best for a child in terms of maximizing participation. These are indications, sadly, of this continued parochialism in the game, and also this continued fragmentation in the game. And so, you know, what's it going to take? You know, it's a good question. You know, I just, believe it or not, and the names will be changed, but, you know, I've been involved with a prominent college and post-college player around my era. I've been involved with trying to assist with him getting the support he needs, having likely, he's likely suffering from this cumulative concussion impact on his brain and suffering as a result. And I think the more that we, the more that we can kind of demystify that, the more that we can try to make sure parents understand, and more importantly, tournament owner operators and league operators understand that there's wisdom around unified rules and policies. These are not trying to micromanage people or suggest that they don't know what they're doing. It's more, you know, we need to do what's best for the child. And what's best for the child, quite frankly, is what's best for the sport. You know, the more comfortable a child and parents feel with playing lacrosse, the longer they're going to be in the game. The better experience they have, the longer they're going to be in the game. And sadly, we're at a stage in our sport where growth is flattening. And that's in a large part that's due to reduced funding, privatization. But little things like feeling safe or feeling welcomed are major. They're no longer little things. They're significant. And so I'm going off on a bit of a tangent there. But this issue of, you know, you've hit on the two biggest issues I think our sport faces in terms of getting to 2X. You know, we got 950,000 people at all levels playing the game-ish on a consistent basis. How are we going to get to 1.9 million? How are we going to double that number? The only way we're going to get close to doubling that number is make sure that the quality of experience is excellent, which means minimizing injury. And the second way we're going to get there is to increase accessibility of the sport to every family and make sure our culture is welcoming to every family.
So if those are two of the most important issues from the bottom up grassroots level fueling of the pyramid, is it fair to say that the most important issue at the top down level is this pursuit of Olympic inclusion? And one of the things that I didn't bring up earlier is that in addition to your role with US Lacrosse, you're also the vice president of World Lacrosse, which is an entity that's also gone through a similar type of formation during the last 20 years and really checked a lot of boxes over the course of the last 15, including most recent, well, maybe not most recently, but recently rebranding itself from the Federation of International Lacrosse into World Lacrosse. Will you continue in that capacity as vice president, and how does international development and the U.S. national team development and the prospect of Olympic inclusion in 2028 fit into this paradigm and point of view?
Yeah, well, so I serve an elected term as vice president. I've got one that my current term is up in July of next year, so I'll continue in that elected capacity through my term for sure. And I don't know what role I might have with World Lacrosse moving forward. But I'm certainly committed to the vision that World Lacrosse has established. And, you know, this is another, as you know, Terry, highly controversial goal, I guess. And the reason it's highly controversial is because World Lacrosse has developed a new discipline of the game, which is intended to do two things. One, support World Lacrosse's efforts to grow the game internationally and build the number of nation members of the International Federation, but also to, as you mentioned, to qualify the sport for Olympic consideration in 2028, which is our goal. And so there are those who feel that field lacrosse or the traditional, even the field rules, as most of your listeners, I'm sure, know, at the international level are different from those at the NCAA level, for example. But there's tremendous controversy among some that World Lacrosse shouldn't be compromising, the sport, if you will, by creating a smaller-sided discipline, that if we can't get in the Olympics with either the current international field disciplines or the NCAA disciplines, that we should abandon the Olympics as a driver of growth. I completely disagree with that. I think that, first of all, what World Lacrosse is not doing is de-emphasizing the field disciplines. They will continue to be significant. There's disciplines for World Lacrosse, both at the U20 level and the senior level, as will men's box and I'm sure soon women's box. But, you know, to grow the game internationally, and I think sadly in North America, not everybody's, we're pretty ethnocentric and focused on North America, not how we're going to grow the game in the rest of the world. But to grow the game in the rest of the world, you have to understand what limits the growth of in the rest of the world, and that is resources, financial and otherwise, whether that's field access or that's coaching access or even in the early years of a nation, player access, right? And so the field discipline requires a whole lot more players to actually play a game, and it's as simple as that. And what we're trying to do is create a discipline that makes it easier for nations to start the game, to establish organizations and initiate play with a new sport. At the Olympic level, there's no bigger sports marketing property in the world. And there are those who fully believe that perhaps the Olympics are somehow losing their luster. World Lacrosse does not believe that, that the Olympics are still the largest sports marketing property on the planet, and they engage more nations than any other multi-sport competition on the planet, and that if we're able to get the stick and ball game in the Olympics, we know as lacrosse, that is going to significantly expand the exposure of our sport. It's going to generate additional media and financial resources for World Lacrosse to continue to fuel its mission to grow the game, and it will be a win-win. And so, I have to agree that there are some who I think have irrational fears about, well, if there's a small-sided discipline that is very successful internationally and is added to the Olympic program, perhaps is that going to erode the traditional versions of the field lacrosse in the United States? You know, I just think that's irrational. That's an irrational fear. I think, certainly everybody's looking at the future of college sport in the United States, specifically non-revenue college sport. Where is the funding going to come from, particularly for large team sports? As we know, men's and women's Division I programs, there's some this year, it's a unique year, carrying 60 plus people. In a normal year, non-COVID year, 50 is not unusual. So large non-revenue team sports and non-revenue team sports generally at the intercollegiate level, there are issues there with where's the funding going to come from for those, particularly, how's name, image, and likeness going to impact non-revenue sports as well? That's a different topic. But I truly believe that exposing the sport to the world, a version of the sport to the world, through the Olympic program will be a game changer in terms of global appeal of the game and domestic appeal of the game. And I'll close this by saying, what people conveniently forget is we already have multiple disciplines of the sport. We've got the women's game, we've got box, we've got the men's game. And the roots of the game was shared with the world, by Native Americans. And, the version of the sport that was played prior to kind of the formal rules that we see today was very different as well. So this concept that we can't innovate with the rules, to me, it's irrational, I think, and that we need to do our best, back to my prior point, to balance tradition and respect tradition and honor tradition. We also want to think intelligently about innovation and how we can expose more and more people to this great sport.
The last thing I want to touch on before letting you go is one of the points that you just addressed, which is U.S. Lacrosse as an organization is the steward of the sport in the United States in a way that, as we've already laid out, is expansive and has been very successful. But also part of this is an acknowledgement and respect for the traditional roots of the game and its Native American origins. How has that identity been, kind of reaffirmed, so to speak, over the course of the last year as part of this conversation about inclusivity and representation? And certainly as the notion of global growth and prospect of inclusion in multi-sport competition, especially the Olympics and what's necessary from a being recognized by the IOC standpoint, realizing that the Iroquois Nationals fall outside of U.S. Lacrosse's purview in almost every respect, and they have their own organization that makes decisions for its team and its youth development. How is that a part of both U.S. Lacrosse's profile and your successor's responsibility going forward?
Yeah, it's a major part of it. And I think, that is also an area that I think U.S. Lacrosse clearly has not done the job that it could have done. I think we certainly honor the sport's Native American heritage. The challenge, however, is that I think sport-wide, it's evolved into a novelty rather than a fundamental part of the sport's culture. And Lyle Thompson and others with whom I've had the chance to talk over the last year, and others connected with the Iroquois Nationals, again, have really opened my eyes to the to that kind of fact, that the sport's Native American heritage, we all know that it's a significant point of differentiation for our sport. We all know that World Lacrosse is the only international sports federation that recognizes a native people as an independent nation. you know, that is unique and a wonderful part of our game, that the sports originators not only remain a member of the Sports International Federation, but are among the best, the best nations competing in the sport centuries later. These are all incredible points of differentiation for our sport. But I think, you know, again, I'm fortunate that I've had longstanding relationships with people like Orrin Lyons and Rex Lyons, who, you know, Orrin started the Iroquois Nationals, and, he has been someone who I consider a friend, and certainly I've learned a lot from him, and I've got a lot to learn moving forward. But I think we've got to move this point about the sport, the sport's Native American heritage being more of a novelty in recent years, and shifting that to really turning it on its head and making sure we're leading efforts such that Native American history is an integral part of its culture, of our sports culture today, the sports culture today. These are critical, I think, cultural steps the sport not only should take, because it's the right thing to do, because it's appropriately recognizing and honoring and celebrating the sport's history, but it's also the smart thing to do. I mean, this is an incredible differentiator for our sport, and we should work in tandem with Native American leaders to share this sport as such. Moving forward in terms of World Lacrosse's Olympic aspiration, you know, there's no doubt that World Lacrosse, Canada Lacrosse, U.S. Lacrosse are all strong partners and strong advocates for Iroquois Nationals. If we're fortunate enough, and it's a big if, to be invited to be a part of the Olympics in 2028 or at some point after, you know, we believe strongly that the Iroquois Nationals are, need to be there, they need to be there. And we're working very diligently with the Iroquois Nationals, U.S. Lacrosse is, but also World Lacrosse is, and Canada Lacrosse is, to best position them for inclusion. The Iroquois Nationals also have made tremendous commitments within their organizational structure to best position themselves for consideration in that regard. And that is our goal, is to celebrate lacrosse to the world in the Olympics, making sure that the originators of the sport are there, if we are so fortunate to get that exposure. So it's this is a tremendous opportunity for the sport. It's a tremendous opportunity for us to showcase the uniqueness of our sport, the depth of history and culture of our sport, and the excitement of our sport all at once.
Well, Steve, we covered a ton of ground. I couldn't be more grateful for your time and want to commend you and congratulate you on all that you've accomplished with U.S. Lacrosse. I want to wish you the best of luck to you and your family going forward as you enjoy a period of unplugging and mental refreshment, and certainly wish luck to those involved with picking your successor, who will have incredibly large shoes to fill. So thank you once again, and hopefully we have a couple more opportunities to do this either before or after your time as U.S. Lacrosse CEO officially comes to an end.
Terry, I appreciate the opportunity. I want to also say that I also appreciate the friendship we've forged over the years. I'm proud of what you've done and the commitment you've made through Inside Lacrosse and more broadly to really, expand the sport. And I'm looking forward to watching you as the years progress to see how much greater influence you have. Take it easy.